Welcome back, Question Medicine 2020. This is Andrew Billet down here in sunny St. Petersburg, Florida. You know the deal by now. Another day, another dollar, another week, another podcast. Here we are in another week, another podcast. So let's get in what I'm getting on. Let's talk about what I'm talking about. And again, this is Question Medicine 2.0. If you have never listened to Question Medicine before, this is the first time. I'll tell you there are a lot of changes happening. Sound design, microphones, quality, the system that I'm using. It is all a work in progress, my friends. I can tell you it'll never be perfect the first time. It probably won't be perfect the second, third, or fourth time, but it is all a work in progress. And please let me know what you do and don't like about the new updates or the new changes. That is AndrewBuelt, B-U-E-L-T, at gmail.com. And with that, without any further hesitation, without any reservation, let's kick this thing off. It is good to be back. All right, here we go. Question Medicine 2020. And let's just jump right into it. In this article in JAMA, you see, most of the time, physicians, we are stuck in our ways. We are stuck in what we do because what we do is what we do, and that's why we do it. Usually, the most common drug you're going to order is the drug that you just ordered. The most common injection that you're going to give is the injection that you just gave in the last room. We all get comfortable with our day-to-day routines, which is why changes from bench to bedside take something around 15 to 20 years, because we need all new physicians to come in and completely change what we do. But then it takes another 20 years to get all new physicians in there, which is this huge delay in medical progress, or medical care, I guess you could say. But there has to be a way that we can move the needle a little faster. There has to be a way that we can maybe force the hand of the provider. There just has to be a way, right? Well, that's exactly what this study in JAMA Internal Medicine set out to find. It's titled Comparison of Payment Changes and Choosing Wisely Recommendations for the Use of Low-Value Laboratory Tests in the United States and Canada. In this study, they looked at two recommendations that were based on the Choosing Wisely campaign and comparing low-value testing rates after the Choosing Wisely recommendations based on pre-recommendation ordering trends, and then compared the vitamin D level testing after the 2010 payment policy change in Ontario, Canada. That was a lot, and that was taken pretty much straight from the article, but here's what they did. They had three different time frames. The first time frame was just the initial point-blank time frame. How many vitamin D levels were you ordering? Then you had the amount of vitamin D levels that were being ordered after the Choosing Wisely campaign came out and said, don't order vitamin D anymore. Then you had the amount of vitamin D levels that were ordered after Canada said, we are no longer going to pay for this test. And the goal was to find out if healthcare systems would make a change based on recommendations, such as the Choosing Wisely campaign, or if you had to take a full system financial change in order to really change current practice. The 2010 policy eliminating reimbursement from Ontario, Canada, which says we are no longer going to provide you any money for ordering this vitamin D screening test. So primary care doctors, order it all you want. We don't care. We're not going to do it. What was the decreased rate of vitamin D? It was about 93%. Yeah, it's funny when you take away the reimbursement for something that has good or bad or no evidence for it whatsoever, all of a sudden, people stop doing it. Funny how that works. But what about the Choosing Wisely campaign? This is a big, huge undertaking. They give all these recommendations and they say, don't do this, don't do this, don't do this, do this, do this. How often were the Choosing Wisely recommendations followed, or what was the decrease rate in vitamin D ordering test? And it was, well, about 5%. That's right, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, children of all ages, you have 93%, close to 95%. If you took away reimbursement for it, you had 5% if you just made it a recommendation. Oh, another one bites the dust, but I think the take home here is if you want to change practice, then you have to change the financial incentives. We can all say what we want, but money talks, and this study clearly shows it. I have often thought to myself, maybe an insurance company out there should just hire me to come in, make a couple rules, couple changes, a couple guideline indications, and for things that they will and will not pay for, and I'll just take just a fraction. I'll just skim a little bit off the top, and then I would sit here and do the rest of Questioning Medicine on a deserted island somewhere in the Bahamas. And with that, let's move on to the next article. The next article is looking at physical therapy versus meniscectomy in arthritis in patients with meniscus tears. Basically, if you come in and you have a meniscus tear, what do we do? Should we send you to physical therapy, or should we go in with a little bit of surgery, make a little snip snip, and take out part of the meniscus? Which one helps? Well, it turns out in this paper in Arthritis Rheumatology, there were no difference at the 5-year outcomes. This is based on the Meteor study, which was previously published in the New England Journal of Medicine, in which they took patients, 350 of them, with a meniscus tear and mild to moderate osteoarthritis to either physical therapy alone or to a little snip snip followed by physical therapy. There was quite a bit of contamination or crossover in this. Those individuals that randomized to physical therapy would cross over to surgery. So you can't quite say that necessarily it is only better to do physical therapy, but there was no difference. There was no difference in the intention to treat analysis that showed any benefit for physical function and pain improved. The two groups were absolutely equal at 6 and 12 months. And when they followed them up at 5 years, there was still no difference in pain or function. In fact, not only was there no difference, there was no difference in the benefit, but there was difference in harm. You see, in the as-treated analysis, those individuals that underwent meniscectomy, a little snip-snip of their meniscus, were more likely to undergo a total knee replacement than those individuals who received physical therapy alone. 10% versus 2%. That's an absolute difference of 8%, which leads to a number needed to treat of around 12. This difference is huge. Basically, what I'm saying there is, for every 12 patients that you send for a meniscectomy compared to going to physical therapy, well, every 12 patients, you're looking at then one total knee replacement. In the end, big take home here is, if you have a patient that comes in with a torn meniscus, you should do physical therapy alone first prior to going to any kind of surgery or any kind of procedure. And then if physical therapy fails, well then, obviously, surgery could be an option. Now, let me give you my 2 cents on this article. Yes, I get it that if you were randomized to surgery, you were more likely to have a total knee replacement. And if you were randomized to physical therapy and then you crossed over to surgery, the meniscectomy, well, then you were also more likely to have a total knee replacement. Both of those ended up with total knee replacements about 10% of the time. But this study, when you really dig into the numbers, shows that when it comes to function and pain score, there was a difference. There was about a 1.5 point improvement in the first 3 months to those randomized to surgery compared to those randomized to physical therapy. And then from months 3 to 12, there was no difference, and then there was no difference from 1 year to 5 years. So 1.5 points improvement per month for 3 months. That's a 4.5, because 1.5 times 3, 4.5 point improvement if you were randomized to surgery. And that sounds great, except, as many of my listeners will know, you always have to ask, what is the scale? Because 4.5 points on a 10-point scale is pretty significant. However, 4.5 points was not significant, because the scores were on a 0 to 100 scale, with 0 representing extreme knee pain and 100 representing no knee problems whatsoever. This was based on the knee injury and osteoarthritis outcome score, or the KOOS recommendation, or the KOOS calculator. And so then you might ask yourself, well, based on this KOOS calculator, what is a clinically significant change? And according to a paper that I found online in the Journal of Health Quality and Life Outcomes titled Knee Injury and Osteoarthritis Outcome Scores, KOOS score, from joint to injury osteoarthritis, they determined that you need about a 10-point change of improvement or a 10-point change in decline to actually see any clinically significant benefit. So what happens when you go to surgery? You get about a 4.5-point benefit in pain and function, but that is not even clinically significant. Yep, that's right. It's the horn already. But we're going to spend the next many, many, many minutes covering an article that I think was completely blown out of proportion. Earlier this year, 2020, January 2nd, New England Journal of Medicine, a paper titled Comparison of Two LDL Cholesterol Targets After Ischemic Stroke. When this paper was launched, when this paper came out, the big thing that was said among all of the people that were reviewing this was, oh my goodness, this is finally the evidence that we've all been looking for. This is the evidence that tells us that using LDL numbers after a stroke actually is beneficial. This is the paper that shows us using a precise LDL target is really beneficial. And so this means that we should use precise LDL targets because that's exactly what this trial showed. Except for it's not at all what this trial showed. And I'm going to tell you why. You see, the target level or the target LDL cholesterol to reduce cardiovascular events after a stroke really hasn't been that well studied. And in this paper, they set out to determine what if we did study it in a good way, well, or at least a randomized way, and they randomly assigned patients with ischemic stroke in the previous 3 months or a TIA within the previous 15 days to a target LDL cholesterol of 70 or lower, or to a target range between 90 and 110. Now, before we go any further, when you're looking at a 70 or lower or a, let's say, 100 between 90 to 110, so right about 100, there is at least a 30-ish percent difference in the lab variability of most assays for cholesterol. So when you're looking at these numbers and the confidence intervals around these lab values that you're getting back on your piece of paper, you can't even precisely say on an individual patient level that there is a real difference. Now, on a grand global scale like they did here, you can say that there's a difference because you have a whole bunch of numbers, you can average them out. But on an individual patient sitting in front of you in the room, you can't necessarily say that there is a difference on that one individual person. But back to the paper at hand. The investigators or the doctors or the physicians, the providers were allowed to prescribe any type of medication, any statin, any cholesterol lowering medication that they wanted to. They were not confined to a certain type or a certain dose. The composite primary endpoint was major cardiovascular events, which included ischemic stroke, myocardial infarction, or new symptoms leading to an urgent coronary or carotid revascularization or death from cardiovascular causes. In the end, the patients were followed for 3.5 years, and the mean or the average LDL cholesterol was 65 in the lower target group and 96 in the higher target group. The composite primary outcome of these major cardiovascular events that they combined all into one just major pot of garbage occurred in approximately 121 patients in the lower target group and 156 patients in the higher target group. For those of you following along at home, that means that there was a difference of 25 extra events that occurred in those individuals that had a higher LDL. And that was the ticket. That was the ticket that everyone talked about and said, oh my goodness, look at this, 25 extra events over 3.5 years to these individuals who had higher LDLs. This must mean something. Except this is where we're going to get nerdy, we're going to break it down, and we're going to talk about why they are wrong. First of all, the primary endpoint, which as I described was a composite of major cardiovascular events, including ischemic stroke, myocardial infarction, new symptoms leading to urgent coronary or carotid revascularization, or death from cardiovascular causes. Of all these that they put together in a big bundle, none of them, not one of them, not a single one of them was statistically significant in and of themselves. But when you combine them all together, their powers forced into one big composite outcome, well, then they were significant. Again, I hate composite outcomes because you can just add anything. I mean, the one that really surprises me is symptoms leading to urgent coronary or carotid revascularization. So basically, if you just have an overzealous cardiologist who wants to take you to PCI, then you qualified. I mean, come on, man. Now, let's move on to other reasons that they are still so wrong. Plausibility. We've talked about it on Question Medicine before. When you looked at the actual numbers, if you had a stroke, well, then in the subgroup analysis, it showed that you benefited from a lower LDL number. But if you had a TIA, which is essentially a much smaller or minor stroke, then you actually benefited from the higher target LDL number. That doesn't make any sense. There is no way that a more severe stroke should benefit from one type of LDL number, and then a less severe stroke would benefit from a much higher LDL number. I don't buy it. I don't believe it. Next, they had 141 patients lost to follow-up. Just gone. Poof. Vamoose. What happened to those patients? We don't know. And then, let's talk about something that I think is important for everyone to know, and that is the fragility index. The fragility index, you say? Oh, yes. The fragility index, he said. The fragility index is a measure of the robustness, or how fragile, the results of a clinical trial are. The fragility index is a number indicating how many patients would be required to convert a trial from being statistically significant to not statistically significant. Better said, that if you had, let's say, I'm making up the numbers here, but 100 patients that had an event, but if you only had 99 patients that had the event, then no longer would the trial be statistically or clinically significant anymore. It would have been a negative trial, but at 100, all of a sudden the scale is tipped and now it's a positive trial. Well, then the fragility index would say that this had a fragility index of 1, meaning only one patient had to have their outcomes changed in order to change the outcome of the entire study. Well, let's go to the fragility index on this particular paper. And it was, drumroll please, 3. That is right. The fragility index for a primary endpoint is 3, despite having reached statistical significance. That is, if 3 patients in the lower target group were, quote unquote, converted from not having a primary endpoint to having the primary endpoint, the study would lose statistical significance. It is much smaller than the number of patients lost to follow-up, 141. So it is hard for me to believe that when you lose 141 and your clinical significance or your statistical significance is hanging on 3 lonely patients, that this can be a paper that we can actually use in practice tomorrow with the patient sitting in front of us. And finally, let's look at the rates of statin use. So I had to go to the supplementary data and kind of pull out the numbers. And you see, only 60% of the patients in the low LDL group were on statin-only therapy, while 92% in the higher LDL group were on statin therapy only. If you look at those individuals on intense statin therapy, it was 24% in the low LDL group and only 9% in the high LDL group. And it was 15% difference. Which, said differently, means that you have people on higher doses of statin therapy in the group that was randomized to a lower LDL. Now, I'm going to say that one more time really slow. Basically, if you were in the low LDL group, if you were in the group that needed to be 70 or below, you were taking a higher dose of statin. Point blank, end of story. But what does that mean? Well, it means that a higher dose of statin already has benefit. And we know this because we already have a trial on it. It's the IDEAL study, high dose atorvastatin versus usual dose simvastatin. We know that a higher dose of statin is beneficial. That's where we get the whole atorvastatin 80 milligrams from after you've had a cardiovascular event. This is no surprise to anyone. So really, they were just rerunning the same trial that has already been run. And what about the individuals who were on a statin plus ezetimibe? Well, it was 41% of the individuals in the low LDL group and only 7% in the high LDL group. And once again, we already have the IMPROVE-IT trial. The IMPROVE-IT trial, which was ezetimibe added to statin therapy after an acute coronary syndrome. So basically, you're getting the combination statin and ezetimibe after you have a cardiovascular event. And we already know that it was beneficial to add ezetimibe to statins. Meaning, this study is just showing what we already know. What we've already seen before, that higher doses of statin therapy is better than lower doses of statin therapy if they can tolerate it. And the combination of ezetimibe plus statin is better than just statin all by itself. You see, this trial was not an LDL trial. This was a use a higher dose of statin trial and use a statin with ezetimibe compared to just statin alone trial. And you got the same exact outcomes and results that we've already seen, except that your results were hanging on the fragility index of only 3 patients. which seems a little fishy to me, which is why I am not changing my practice based on this study. Basically, here's what they're going to do. If you have an event, you will come into me, you have a stroke, and you will put you on max statin therapy. And if you can't take max statin therapy, then we'll move you down to a moderate dose and give you ezetimibe. If the patient is really worried, really concerned, says, listen, I've had a stroke, my sister's had a stroke, my mom's had a stroke, my dad's had a stroke, we've all had strokes, well then, max statin therapy and add ezetimibe. But we're not targeting any certain number, and I'm certainly not going to check your LDL to make sure you're down to that number, because this study does not change my practice one bit, one iota, one nunca, not at all. And with that, let's wrap this up and get to the closing credits. So, here we go. If you'd like to change the practice of all providers everywhere, well then you just have to take away their money, because money talks, and it is clearly shown that even when we know don't order a vitamin D, we know you can't order a vitamin D, you shouldn't order vitamin D, it's in every recommendation, every guideline, it's been talked about probably ad nauseum here in Questioning Medicine, it's still being done, and it will be done until you're like Ontario, Canada, and you ban the reimbursement for vitamin D levels. On the next article, which was meniscectomy versus physical therapy, and this is 5-year follow-up. Basically, if you go to surgery, you're going to get better. You are definitely going to get better. About 4.5 points on a 100-point scale in the first 3 months, and then there is absolutely no difference. Physical therapy should be the numero uno, and then followed by surgery if they completely fail physical therapy. And last but not least, and it was a very long breakdown of one study that I think got way too much attention, way too much press, and that is why I don't think we should be doing it. But hopefully you took something away for yourself that you in the future will take with you when you're reading an article that gets all the hype in the world, because it just really isn't that good. When you really break it down, when you really look at the fragility index, when you really look at the composite outcomes, and when you break them down into subgroup analysis of, wait a second, it helps for stroke, but not for TIA. Wait a second, there is not one primary outcome that actually showed a benefit unless you mix it all together. I mean, come on, man. And with that, let's recap real fast. If a patient has a stroke, then max statin therapy. If they can't tolerate max statin therapy, then it is statins plus ezetimibe. And if they can't, and if they're really nervous and they really, really, really want max benefit, then max statin therapy plus ezetimibe. And that is it. No treating to any targets. Not at all. Nunca. And with that, let's end this podcast as we've ended every one before it. Wait for the music. And until next time, keep the quest and questioning.